From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Werewolf by R. Chetwynd Hayes. The house was old and tucked away behind a curtain of trees. A lonely place had been built by a man who loved solitude. Mr. Ferrier liked the company of his fellow beings as much as the next man, but did not have much money, and the hermitage, due possibly to its isolated position, had been very cheap. So he bought the property, moved in with his furniture and family, and began to extol the virtues of a rustic life. Room to move around, he informed a skeptical Mrs. Ferrier, a chance to breathe air that isn't contaminated by petrol fumes. But it's such a long way for Alan to go to school, his wife protested, and the nearest shop is 5 miles away. I tried to warn you, but I might as well have saved my breath.
10 minutes, car ride, Mr. Ferrier retorted impatiently. Besides, there's a traveling salesman who has everything you'll ever need in his van.
And what about social life? Mrs. Ferrier demanded. How will we get to know people, stuck in this out-of-the-way place?
Other people have cars, haven't they? At least give the place a chance. If at the end of 3 months we find the solitude a bit too much, well, I suppose I'll have to look for another house nearer town. Alan was more than content with his new home. After years spent in a large industrial town, he found the rolling moors had much to commend them. He also discovered ruined farmhouses with frameless windows and gaping roofs, the exposed inner walls still retaining patches of flower-pattern wallpaper, and he wondered how long ago the last family had moved away, leaving their home to fall into decay. But one of these relics from a bygone age was not completely deserted. According to an old map which Alan borrowed from the public library, this particular ruin had been called Highborough, a very suitable name as the house stood on the summit of a fairly steep hill and commanded a splendid view of the surrounding countryside. Alan climbed the slope, clambered over a low wall, then walked across an expanse of weed-infested ground that had probably once been a front garden. He mounted 3 crumbling steps and passed through an open doorway, then entered the narrow hall, where the stone floor was coated with dust and a large rat jumped down from a window ledge and went scurrying into a side room. The ceiling had either fallen down or been removed, and Alan could see the room above, which had an iron fireplace clinging precariously to one wall. Higher still were massive beams, each one festooned with writhing cobwebs, the naked bones of a dead house. Alan was about to leave, for there was an indefinable eerie atmosphere about the place, when he heard the sound of ascending footsteps, which seemed to come from beyond the gaping doorway, situated to the left of a dismantled staircase. The footsteps became louder and were intermingled at irregular intervals by an exceedingly unpleasant barking cough. Presently a figure emerged from the doorway and walked slowly into the hall. Alan saw a tall young man with a heavily bearded face and long matted hair that hung down to his slightly bowed shoulders, deep sunken eyes that were indescribably sad, and a set of perfect teeth which were revealed when he again coughed and gasped in a most alarming way. Alan waited until the man had regained his breath and said, "I didn't realize there was anyone here. I was just exploring." The man wiped his brow on the sleeve of his ragged shirt, then spoke with a surprisingly cultivated voice. "That's all right, but I heard you come in and wondered who it could be. Haven't had a visitor for years. This place is rather off the beaten track." "Do you live here?" Alan inquired. The man jerked his head in the direction of the doorway. "Yes, down there."
The cellars are still intact, if rather damp. He sighed deeply. There is no other place I can go. Alan thought there were many places he would rather live than in a damp cellar of a ruined house, particularly if he had such a bad cold. In fact, the man probably had bronchitis, or even pneumonia, for despite the perspiration that poured down his face, he was shivering and could scarcely stand upright. Alan felt a twinge of pity for this strange, lonely person who appeared to have no one to look after him. "Look, I know it's none of my business, but shouldn't you be in bed?" The man nodded and leaned against the wall. "Yes, I suppose I should, but my stores are running low and I must somehow get to the village before." Another fit of coughing interrupted his next words, and Alan made the only suggestion that was possible under the circumstances. "Would you like me to do your shopping?" The man groaned and shivered so violently that Alan became quite alarmed. "It's a long way for you to go and come back," said the man. "I've nothing else to do," the boy replied, although the prospect of tramping back across rugged moorland carrying a heavy shopping bag was not all that attractive. "Well, if you're sure you don't mind, come downstairs and I'll give you some money and some idea of what I require." Alan followed the tall figure through the doorway, down a winding flight of steps and finally into a large underground room, dimly lit by an ancient hurricane lamp. So far as he could see, this dismal place contained little more than an iron bedstead and a rickety chair. "The nearest village is Manville," the man said, pulling a tin box from under the bed, "about 5 miles as the crow flies. Get some tin stuff, like soup and stewed steak. I suppose you couldn't carry a gallon can of paraffin?" "I could try," Alan said ruefully, determined never to explore empty houses again. "I'd be greatly obliged if you could. Otherwise, I'll soon have to lie down here in the dark. Here's 5 pounds. That should cover the cost of all you can carry." "Right." Alan cast a glance at the untidy bed. "You cover yourself up and keep warm. I'll be back as soon as I can." "Thank you very much," the man said. "You are exceedingly kind." Actually, Alan thought, he was too, but just murmured, "Nonsense, no trouble at all," before walking towards the step carrying a leather shopping bag in one hand and an old rusty paraffin can in the other. The greater part of 4 hours passed before Alan arrived back at the ruined house. He ran down the steps and found the sick man sitting up in bed, his face lit by a smile of intense relief. "And I thought you were not coming back. I should have known better." Alan frowned and put the heavy bag and paraffin can down on the floor. "Of course I've come back, but it took me a long time to find that village, and I lost my way coming back." The man shook his head in self-reproach. "Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. And it must have been very hard work lugging that bag and the can over the moors. What have you got?" Alan began to remove tins of food from the leather bag. "I spent most of your 5 pounds. There's tins of stewed steak, mixed vegetables, soups, and some nourishing rice pudding. Now, where's your cooking stove?" The man nodded in the direction of a dark corner. "Over there. You'll find a saucepan and a few odds and ends of crockery." Alan found the oil stove and a very smelly, decrepit piece of apparatus it was too, and after lighting it, he did some oxtail soup, which the man consumed with every sign of satisfaction. "That's marvelous," he said. "I'm beginning to feel much better already." "Would you like some stewed steak now?" Alan asked. The man shook his head. "No, this will keep me going for a bit. Maybe I'll heat something up myself a little later on, but I must thank you for all your trouble. Not many lads of your age would have been so kind." "That's all right," Alan began to back towards the steps. "I'd better get back now, or my parents will start worrying. Would you like me to pop in tomorrow?" For a while the man did not answer, then he said quietly, "I don't think you should." "No, definitely not. Go away and forget you ever saw me. That would be best." Alan wondered if the man had done something wrong and was hiding from the police. It might well be the reason why he was living in this awful place. But he did not look like a criminal nor act like one. After all, he apparently went into Manville to do his shopping. So just before he ran up the steps, Alan said, "Don't worry, I won't tell anyone you're here, and I will come to see you again." Mr. Ferrier brought Charlie Brinkley back from the grape and barley corn, for he was determined to make friends with his nearest neighbors, even if they did live miles away. Charlie was a youngish man with a full red face, a mop of flaxen hair, and a hearty, familiar manner, which did not go down all that well with Mrs. Ferrier. He sank into a chair, accepted a glass of brown ale, winked at Alan, then directed a slightly bovine stare at the good lady. "Must be rather lonely for you out here, ma'am. Not a sight or sign of another body for miles. Wouldn't suit my missus. Likes a bit of company, she does." "It takes all sorts to make a world," Mrs. Ferrier remarked coldly. "It wouldn't do if we were all alike." Charlie emptied his glass, then held it out for replenishment. "Oh, you're not wrong there, ma'am. Right nice drop of beer, this is." Mr. Ferrier smiled amicably, rubbed his hands together, and all but pleaded with his wife to like their guest. "Charlie, in the way of being a sheep farmer," he said heartily. Mrs. Ferrier was clearly not impressed. "Really, how interesting." Charlie shook his head with mock modesty. "I wouldn't go so far as to say that, ma'am. Maybe I've got a few hundred head out there on the moors. Got grazing rights, see? Not much money in sheep these days. Just enough to let me have a scrape of margarine on me dry crust and maybe a spoonful of jam on Sundays." "How distressing for you," Mrs. Ferrier commented. Conversation lagged for a little while after that, until Mr. Ferrier said desperately, "Tell Ethel about that dog, Charlie. The one that's been killing your sheep." "Oh, must be a monster, man. Skulking great brute. Do you know I've found 6 of my best rams with their throats torn out over as many months?" Mrs. Ferrier grimaced and gave the impression that such information was not to her liking, but Charlie was not to be deterred from a subject that was clearly of great interest to him. 3 were ripped to bits, ma'am. Never seen anything like it. Blood and wool everywhere there was." Mrs. Ferrier did not comment, but dabbed her lips with a lace handkerchief, and Alan knew she would speak more sternly to his father once their guests had departed. "But you did catch a glimpse of the beast, didn't you, Charlie?" Mr. Ferrier prompted. "Yes, that I did. One bright moonlit night, last week it were, and a body could see for miles, I was on top of Manstead Tor, and I'd see this thing go prancing across the moors. Must have been 2 miles or more away, so there was no chance of me having a pot shot at it with me old rabbit gun." He took a deep swig from his glass and continued, "But this is the bit which makes the chaps down at the grape and barley corn curl up. Mind you, it's as true as I sit here. It stopped and stood up on 2 feet. May I be struck down if it didn't. Reared up on its hind legs and howled, I dare say," Mrs. Ferry interrupted. "Howled at the moon?" "No, ma'am, begging your pardon for contradicting such a forthright lady as yourself, but it coughed." "Sounds travel on those moors when the wind is in the right direction, and I distinctly heard a barking cough, like a chap who's got a nasty cold on his chest. Then it ran, still on 2 feet, ma'am, over Hangman's Ridge, and I didn't see it no more." Mrs. Ferrier glanced at the clock and assumed an expression of great surprise. "Good gracious, is that the time? I never realized it was so late." Charlie, in no way put out by this broad hint, emptied his glass and stood up. "Ah, I must be pushing on. The missus will think I'm up to something I shouldn't, but I'll get the varmint, never you fret, ma'am. Then everyone will laugh to the other side of their faces." "I'm sure we wish you all good fortune, Mr. Brinkley," Mrs. Ferrier remarked, before crossing the room and opening the door. "I do hope you get home safely." "That I will, ma'am, unless me old bone shaker blows a gasket." Charlie Brinkley departed, and Alan, without being told, went upstairs to bed. He had a lot to think about. 3 days later, Alan Ferrier once again paid a visit to the ruined High Burrow. He had intended never to go near the place again, but the memory of that poor sick man, lying all alone in a damp cellar, had haunted his dreams and spoiled his enjoyment of the perfect summer days. The man might have died, or be on the verge of death, all because a boy had been too frightened by a silly story to keep his promise. So he now climbed over the low wall, walked very slowly across the neglected garden and entered the house. He called out, "Excuse me, is it all right for me to come down?" Presently he heard the sound of a match being struck. Then a voice had said, "Yes, come on down, lad." Alan crept down the steps, not knowing what he was going to see, determined to turn and run should there be the slightest sign of anything alarming. But to his gratified surprise, he found the man standing up and adjusting the flame of the oil lamp. He greeted the boy with a sad smile. "I've been for a little walk and only just got back. I thought I told you to keep away." "I was worried about you," Alan replied, relieved that his one-time patient looked so well and normal. "Are you better?" "It's very nice of you to be so concerned." "Yes, I am much better. There's no fear of my dying, not from a cold." Alan looked around the room. So far as he could see, some effort had been made to tidy it up, for the floor had been swept, the bed stripped, and the blankets folded into neat quarters. "What about your stores?" he asked. "Do you want me to fetch you some more?" "No, thank you. I'm well able to look after myself now. I cook my meals upstairs, in one of the empty rooms." Alan took a deep breath and braced himself to ask the question that had been partly responsible for the fear which had haunted him for 3 days. "Why do you live in this awful place?" "You have plenty of money. I saw lots of banknotes when you opened that tin box." The man sighed and pushed him gently towards the flight of steps. "Let's go up into the light of day, and I'll try to explain." They went up into the devastated hall and out into the overgrown garden. The man led his young friend over to the low wall. "Sit down, son, and listen very carefully. Once I lived in this house with my parents. That was a long time ago, and believe it or not, this was a very pleasant place then. My father farmed the entire expanse of this high ground, and although we were by no means rich, we were quite comfortably off. Then one day a stranger came to Highborough." The man stopped and stared sadly out across the wild moors. Alan knew he must not speak. He had to wait for the story to be completed. Presently the man continued. "Ah, a stranger, a tall, dark man with haunted eyes. He was lost, or so he said, and my father invited him to spend the night here. One full moonlit night. Never has anyone been so ill paid for an act of kindness." He lapsed into silence again, and Alan prompted gently, "What happened?" "What happened indeed. The stranger had a rare disease, and during that one night I was, oh, most merciful God, I was infected. I became as he was. He went away next morning, but I remained. Remained to see my parents die of grief and horror, my old home crumble slowly to the ruin you see now, and watch 100 summers fade into autumn."
100?
Alan gasped. "Yes, maybe more, for the rare disease has a strange side effect. I cannot grow old, or, as far as I know, die a natural death, but I can't expect you to believe that." Then, Alan hesitated, then blurted out what he now knew to be the awful truth. "Then? You must be a werewolf." The man jerked his head round and looked down at the boy with shocked surprise. "You believe that? You can actually accept that I am cursed with the mark of the Pentagon? Indeed, must your generation be gifted with great knowledge?" "I've seen lots of horror films," Alan explained, "and I always thought they were just fantasies. But a man called Charlie Brinkley saw what he thought was a large dog standing up on 2 feet, and it coughed as you did. So I put 2 and 2 together, and it must be awful to be a werewolf." The man nodded and recited the following words. "A man bade me pure of heart and say his prayers at night, but into a wolf he will turn when the moon is full and bright." "You'll never kill people, though, have you?" Alan asked. The man frowned. "No, of course not. Wolves don't unless they're starving and there's no wildlife for them to hunt. But I appear to be rather partial to sheep. Disgusting, isn't it?" Certainly, Alan thought that tearing sheep to pieces was not very nice, and he could only hope they had been killed first. However, he said gently, "You can't help doing what you do. But that man called Charlie Brinkley says he's going to shoot you. Doesn't he have to use a silver bullet?" The man shook his head. "Shouldn't think so. An ordinary bullet can kill a werewolf, or at least injure him. Now, you have heard my story and know why you must not come here again. But you only, well, turn into a wolf when there's a full moon," Alan protested. "There's no reason why I shouldn't visit you during the day." "I'm sure your parents wouldn't approve of you associating with a werewolf," the man said sternly. "I know I wouldn't if you were my son. So, thank you once again for your help and kindness. Now you must go." And without so much as another word, he got up and walked quickly back to the house. Presently, Alan climbed the low wall and wandered dejectedly down the hill and out across the moors. Every evening, Alan would peer up at the gradually increasing disk of bright light and try to imagine how his friend in the ruined house was feeling, knowing he must soon be transformed into a dreadful monster. Then came the night when a full moon rode a cloudless sky, and Charlie Brinkley paid another visit to the hermitage. "That awful man has just parked his dreadful car in our drive," Mrs. Ferrier informed her husband. "I saw him from the bedroom window, and I'm sure he's drunk. That must be him ringing the doorbell now. Tell him I've got a headache." Charlie was not drunk, but very excited. "Saw the brute again," he gasped, "running across Blackheath. I had to come back for me gun. In fact, two guns." "Thought you'd like to come with me, old chap. You can take up a position on Manstead Tor, and with me patrolling Hammond's Ridge, one of us should be able to pot him." Mr. Ferrier's eyes sparkled with excitement. "Count me in. Hang on a second, and I'll have a word with the wife, and then I'll join you. Do we need my car?" "No. Have to walk most of the way." Alan, who had stationed himself in the hall, did not hesitate. He slipped out of the back door and ran up the narrow path which led to the moors. The wind, which in this wild place was like a wailing, never-resting ghost, tore at Alan's hair and seemed to be trying to hold him back with invisible arms. But he continued to trot forward, even though his laboring heart and rasping lungs warned him that the limit of endurance would soon be reached. He had no idea what would happen when, or should, he come face to face with a raging werewolf. There was only the overwhelming urge to warn his friend that two hunters would soon be on his track, each one armed with a loaded rifle. Manstead Tor stood out against the moonlit sky, a gently sloping hill that flowed up from a sea of heather to a grass-covered crown. Opposite and about a quarter of a mile away was Hangman's Ridge, a long high mound that, according to local tradition, had at one time been a place of execution. Alan stopped running when he saw the sheep. They were bunched together on the lower slopes of the ridge, looking like a large gray shadow. They stirred uneasily when the broyo approached them. Suddenly, he knew what must be done. The sheep were the only reason why the werewolf would come to this part of the moor. If he could drive them from the valley before his father and Charlie Brinkley arrived, then his friend might live to see another sunrise. He shouted, uprooted a clump of heather, and waved it from side to side. The sheep became a protesting, heaving mass that began to slowly move down into the valley as Alan raised his voice to a higher pitch. His was not an easy task, for the disturbed animals insisted on milling round in circles, and one or two would not budge at all, but stood still and stared at him with pathetic reproach. He finally managed to get them all on the move, and might well have succeeded in driving them from the valley had not a sudden terrifying howl shrieked out from Hangman's Ridge. There was no controlling the sheep after that. They ran in every direction. They burrowed deep into the heather, bumped into each other, and raced up and down the slopes. When Alan raised his eyes, he all but turned and ran away himself. Long afterwards, he decided that not one film producer had ever laid eyes on a werewolf, for the creature that was advancing towards him bore not the slightest resemblance to any of the monsters he had seen in the cinema. The head was round, the ears large, hairy, and tapering to sharp points. The face, which was narrow and sloped down to the slavering mouth, was covered with black matted fur. But it was the eyes that made Alan wish he had stayed at home. They were sunken and bright red, little pools of liquid fire that appeared to gleam with ferocious hate. The body was that of a deformed man, bent shoulders, long arms that terminated in curved claws, the ghastly white skin sparsely covered by long strands of reddish hair. The creature still wore a torn shirt and a pair of stained gray trousers. The werewolf ran forward, its claws brushing the ground, then stopped and it reached a point that was just a few feet from the terrified boy. The grotesque head went back, the jaws slowly parted to reveal sharp pointed teeth. Then a low growl rose to a full-throated roar. Alan screamed. "No, no, I'm your friend. Don't you know me?" The roar died away and the monster became still, a dark, menacing figure that gave the impression it might explode into lethal activity at any moment. Then it shuffled forward, lowered its head, and sniffed. Alan shuddered when the long snout traveled up his left arm, across his chest, and finally muzzled his right ear. Then the werewolf whined. A dog that wishes to be petted, fed, or taken for a walk might have made some such sound. It could also have come from an unhappy creature who, through no fault of its own, had been cursed with the stigma of a monster. Alan's fear drained away and was replaced by a warm flood of pity. His friend, the gentle, kindly man with the sad eyes, was imprisoned in that hideous form, pleading for understanding, forgiveness, a morsel of affection. Alan was about to lay his hand on that unlovely head when there came the sound of a rifle shot, a single muffled report that came from the ridge. The werewolf's jerked upright gave one terrible cry of despair, then went bounding across the valley and disappeared behind Manstead Tor. Alan was crying when Charlie Brinkley and Mr. Ferrier reached him. His father put an arm around his shoulders and said, "Thank God you're all right, son. When I saw that awful creature so close to you..." "I got him," Charlie Brinkley interrupted, his voice trembling with excitement. "Right between the shoulders. He won't last long. Biggest dog I ever saw. And did you see? It stood up on its hind legs. You'll tell those nincompoops down in the grape and barley corn, won't you? It stood upright." "I think," Mr. Ferrier said, leading his young son away, "the least we say about this night's work, the better. I would rather not believe what I saw." But Alan could only repeat over and over again, "He couldn't help being a werewolf. He wouldn't have harmed me." It was 2 days before Alan was allowed to go out on his own, for the doctor said he was suffering from shock and needed time to recover. When he reached Tyboro, he found it sleeping under a benign sky, with moths fluttering among the harebells in the overgrown garden, and the wind breathing through the grass, and knew that tranquility had returned to this once happy homestead. He walked slowly down the stone steps and directed the beam of his torch round the desolate cellar. The man who had been a werewolf lay on the bed. He was dead, but on his face was the most beautiful smile that Alan had ever seen. Presently he covered the body with a blanket, then remounted the steps. He never went back. Cry Wolf by Basil Copper. The village is very quiet, but then that is to be expected at this time of year. It stands in a notch of the frowning mountains far from the nearest town, and after all, it is the main reason we bought the house. In summer, the meadows are carpeted with red and yellow flowers, while in the winter, the majesty of the snow and the unearthly beauty of the mountains against those changing skies more than compensates for the cold and the lack of modern amenities. The wolf came early in November. That in itself was curious because the weather had been mild until then. It was first reported by Jackal, the frontier guard. He had seen a trace of its paws down by the stream in the moonlight, he said. Even an outsider like myself could not resist chafing him. Wolves had not been known in these mountains for generations, said the older heads of the village. Now, if it had been much higher up, or on the Italian side, and January as well, and one of the hardest winters on record, but a mild November, they flung up their hands with laughter and continued smoking their long pipes. Jekyll just smiled and said he knew what he knew, and he trusted the evidence of his own eyes. A big dog, perhaps, said Jean Pitor, who owned the largest general store in the village. Jekyll derided the suggestion. Quite impossible, he said firmly. It was a wolf's print coming down a path from the village to the stream. In fact, he'd seen the animal, or at least its shadow, passing over the snow a few seconds before. Even allowing for the moonlight and the elongation of the shadow, it had been too big for a dog, and the pads were enormous. Jekyll said that, to settle it. Why don't we all come down to have a look at the prints ourselves? We were gathered in the auberge at the time, and it was warm and friendly, and the vintage was uncommonly good that year. So only a few of the less comfort-addicted spirits said they would go along. I went too, together with my son Andrew, who was eager to see the track of this fabulous beast. We had a disappointing afternoon. The village children were using the path as a toboggan slide after this new snowfall, and nothing remained by then. Let us try by the stream, said Jean Le Couteur, who apart from owning a logging company was also mayor of the village. So aside from his natural authority, coupled with that of his office, it was also his duty to look into the matter. We drew a blank there, too. Jekyll was puzzled and humiliated. He looked at the turned-up snow in disgust and scratched his head. He spat thoughtfully. Le Couteur remained on his knees for a moment, staring at the ground. "You are certain this is the place?" he asked the frontier guard. The latter turned and surveyed the length of the stream. As you can see, the remainder of the banks are covered in virgin snow, he said simply. The mayor got to his feet and brushed down his trousers. It seems as though someone has obliterated the tracks with a rough broom, he said in a puzzled voice. There was a general laugh among the men who had accompanied us, but I noticed we all went back to the village in a thoughtful frame of mind. That was the simple beginning, and nothing else happened for more than 2 weeks. Then a frightened child came running into the hamlet one evening, to say he'd been chased by a big dog. The child was obviously terrified, and his clothes had been torn by something sharp and jagged, so his family were forced to take the story seriously. They sent for the mayor and the doctor, and within half an hour a search party was organized. I joined it naturally, and though Andrew was anxious to go, I told him to stay behind. He was only 15, and I knew that he might do something foolish in his excitement. We all got lanterns and big electric torches and thoroughly searched the track along which the boy had been coming. Sure enough, there were large paw marks right behind the half impressions of the boy's running feet. There was no joking that night, and a noticeable tremulousness in the voice of some of those who made suggestions. Le Couteur sent back to the village for his rifle and a message summoning the best shots in the community. We left two men to guide them down. After the attack on the boy, the paw marks circled aimlessly and then started to go downhill. They followed the path the village children used as a slide and then went into the stream and disappeared. This was strange in itself, as wolves avoid water except for drinking purposes. We were circling up and down when there was the crack of a rifle. "The opposite bank," shouted Jekyll, his eyes bright with excitement. Smoke curled thinly from the barrel of his rifle. He pointed into the thicket on the opposite bank. We all distinctly heard a crackling noise following the shot. "Now perhaps you'll believe me," said Jekyll with quiet triumph. "If it satisfies you, this is serious enough," the mayor agreed. By now, the riflemen from the village had arrived, alarmed by the shot and disappointed at being cheated of a chance at getting the animal. The mayor led the way back in, having decided that it was too dark and dangerous to attempt to ford the stream and seek the beast out that night. He consulted with a doctor over the boy, who was found to have only minor scratches, and then telephoned the civil authorities to put them on their guard. The auberge was packed that evening, while we all debated the events of the day. When we got back to the house, I found the door locked. Andrew's voice, shaken and hushed, sounded from inside. He opened up when I called to him. "I was frightened, Father," he said. "I think the wolf was here about half an hour ago. I heard something padding round the house and a snarl like a dog, so I locked the door quickly." "You were very wise, son," I comforted him. "Shall we go and look for it?" said Andrew. I got angry then. After all, Andrew was the only thing I had left in the world, now that his mother had gone. "That is what we won't do," I said. "If you've had your supper, get off to bed. The authorities will handle this." I telephoned the mayor, and presently another party arrived. We went over the ground minutely. We found the wolf's tracks outside the main balcony windows of the house. L'Écouteur looked grave. "We'll have to keep the young people indoors after dark until this is over," he said. "I'll see if we can get some extra rifles up from the militia until the beast is shot." We followed the tracks half-heartedly for a few hundred yards. We saw they went in the general direction of the village path before we turned back. A party sat up at my house drinking cognac into the small hours discussing the affair. Nothing happened for a week. Then there were further scares. Two little girls had looked from their window one night and had seen the wolf, as big as a cow, they said, though everyone allowed for their childish imagination, running across the meadow near their house. When their mother had come, alarmed by their screams, all they could see was a thin man running across the field, probably in pursuit of the wolf. Then two goats, which were kept under cover at Papa Grémillon's, one of the last farms at the edge of the village, were found half-eaten and with their throats torn out. A minor wave of panic swept the district. One of the most alarming aspects of the business was that the outhouse in which the goats were kept had been padlocked and the key left in the lock. Whoever had killed the goats and the prints and evidence of the fierce struggle among the beast pointed unmistakably to a wolf, had first unlocked the padlock and then turned the key again on leaving. When these facts became generally known, the unease became tinged with terror. L'Écouteur and I and some of the more undaunted members of the community talked the affair over for long hours in the auberge. It was while we were there one bitter afternoon shortly after Christmas that the rumor of the loup-garou first came to be mentioned. "A lot of superstitious nonsense among the hill people," snapped L'Écouteur. "The legend of a man-wolf is as old as these mountains," he added, turning to me. "There may be something in it," said someone further down the table. "The story of a man who can change into a wolf to kill his prey and then turn back into a man again has come from classical times." "So have many things," said L'Écouteur, his face purple with outraged indignation. "But that doesn't mean we have to believe minotaurs are still running about." "But how do you account for this beast's cleverness?" said Jackal disarmingly. "And what about that padlock at Papa Grimillon's?" The mayor stroked his chin, downing his glass of water spirit. "I don't doubt we've got something serious here and something fiendishly clever," he said. "But I exclude the supernatural. We've got enough to think about at the moment." There was not one of us who disagreed with him on dispersing, but after that things gradually got worse. Some soldiers on winter maneuvers in the mountains came for a bit, boosted the custom in the cafes, and escorted the children to and from their various errands. Nothing happened of note. Some of the young National servicemen fired off their rifles at shadows, alarming the countryside, and when the weather closed in, blocking the pass, the militia were of course withdrawn. We were left to our own resources. The first deaths occurred in March, with the warmer weather. There was little René Foss, a 12-year-old schoolboy, who was found with his throat torn out one night, only a few yards from his back door. He had been on his way to the barn to see the stock were all right. With the deaths of the two small sisters later the same week, then truly began the reign of terror. Paw prints of the wolf were found on each occasion, but the creature was fiendishly cunning, as the mayor had hinted. Despite the combing of foothills by massive search parties aided by militia, the prints always ceased at the stream, and searches up and down the banks always failed to find the place where the beast had once again regained the ground. During all this time, hardly anyone had spotted the animal which fed the legend of the werewolf, a legend which was seized on first by the regional and then the national press. Hordes of journalists came with their cameramen. Everyone was interviewed, old griefs disinterred, and any clues there might have been of the beast's whereabouts were soon obliterated by the boots of hundreds of sightseers. Then at the end of March or early April, just before the snow was due to disperse, we had a report that an adult this time had been attacked. He was a man named Charles Badaw, a mechanic at the village's only garage, who lived in one of the smaller houses at the end of the settlement. The beast had jumped on his back from an embankment as he was returning on foot from work and had torn a piece out of his neck. With great courage, Badaw had fought it off. Fortunately for him, he was still carrying a box of tools, and as he was a big man and made such a threatening sight as he whirled the box around his head with the strength of despair, the wolf had given up the attack and slunk off. Swathed in bandages and fortified by cognac, Badaw reclined on a sofa at the doctor's house and told his story. Lecouture swiftly organized one of his biggest search parties, and this time I allowed Andrew to join on the condition that he kept close to me and didn't handle any firearms. Two burly gendarmes from the Police de la Route had been left in the village, and they added a useful stiffening to our party. The wolf had torn away a piece of flesh from the neck of Badaw, and had apparently stopped to eat this no more than a few yards away from the scene of the attack, for we found bloodstains and an area of disturbed snow in a nearby thicket. "This is an audacious brute, all right," gritted Lecouture, grimly as we pressed on, following the clear trail in the snow. But after going in the familiar directions, the paw marks diverted from the track and started up a nearby hill. The wolf may have had its appetite whetted, and might be trying for another victim the other side of the village, I said. Lecouture nodded assent. We plunged uphill for 20 minutes, through quite thick snow, following the clearly defined trail. We all heard the crackling branches at the same time. Andrew gave an excited cry, and the wolf bounded out from behind a clump of fir trees about 50 meters ahead. Several rifles cracked out in a ragged volley, and puffs of disturbed snow made plumes in the air around the big gray animal. One of the shots had apparently connected, for the brute gave a whimpering cry and limped off back into the trees. Encouraged, we plunged after it. I told Lecouture and the gendarmes that I thought one of us had hit it on the front offside paw, and they were inclined to agree. But half an hour later, with the bloodstains growing fainter and dying out before the trail ended at the stream, we had to give up once more. Next morning, Andrew was pale with shock. He had been out for a talk in the village, and on my return found him lying on his bed, immobile with pain. There was a bandage on his right arm. "Don't be angry, Father," he said. "I cut my finger chopping wood. It's not serious." "Have you been to see Dr. Lemaire?" I said, alarmed. "Yes," Andrew assured me, "and he said there's nothing to be concerned about. More painful than anything else." "I'm glad to hear it, my boy," I said, "but you really must be more careful." Truth to tell, I was more worried than I cared to admit. But at supper time, the color had come back into Andrew's cheeks, and he was eating with all his old appetite. The matter slipped my mind as the jangled state of nerves of the villagers gradually came to crisis point. Not that I blamed them, because I was by now almost as nervous at nighttime as anyone, despite the heavy Mauser pistol I kept by my bedside. The mayor had issued a ration of ammunition to every responsible male adult. Like him, I had no patience with the werewolf theories, which many of the villagers were quite openly advocating. But I had to admit that there were many terrible and unexplainable things about this horrifying series of events. Poor Badaw's neck was taking a long time to heal, and he had to be removed to a hospital in a major town 50 kilometers away. But for a miracle, we would have been following his cortege to the local cemetery as the latest in that series of pathetic funerals of earlier victims. We were hoping that the wolf had had the fight knocked out of it by the flesh wound inflicted by our shots, and had retired to the higher mountains. But it was not to be. It was only 2 nights later when the beast struck. In some way known only to itself, it had secreted itself in a locked woodshed almost in the heart of the village. Its audacity was such that it had apparently stayed there all day. In the early evening, the unfortunate old woman who owned the nearby house had short run of fuel for the stove. Opening the door in the semi-darkness of the courtyard, she had had her throat torn out in the first onrush of the wolf, and had died immediately. The beast, not at all incommoded by its wound of 3 nights earlier, had dragged her off to another backyard nearby and had commenced its meal. This delay had enabled the hurriedly summoned shooting party to come up while the beast was still in the vicinity. Lecouture was arguing with some of the more superstitious villagers as Andrew and I got there. "I tell you, could an animal have done this?" said a stolid elderly villager with a walrus mustache, after the problems of the locked shed had been explained. "C'est le loup-garou."
"Werewolf be damned," said Lecouture, choking with rage. "Bullets will put paid to it, the same as any other wolf."
I just pointed out that the missing woman might still be alive, and that we ought to be following up the trail when the most dreadful growl came from the shadows. This was followed by a whirring noise mixed with the sound of snapping bone, which made several members of the party feel sick. We all set off through the maze of courtyards. Someone wheeled a motorcycle with a bright headlamp onto the scene. A gray shadow leaped over a wall as a gun flamed, leaving a scene of grotesque horror behind it. While some of the party remained to take charge and to cover the mangled remains with a tarpaulin, a dozen of us rushed forward to take revenge on this devilish animal. Lecouture and I pressed ahead of the two gendarmes. I had brought Andrew with me to spare him the scenes behind us, and he was well up with the mare and myself. We heard a snarl from the thicket in front, and Andrew dashed ahead with a torch and a thick stick despite my shouts. I called to him to come back, but the party was now wildly spread out. My main fear was flying bullets from excitable trigger fingers, as I didn't imagine that the wolf would stop. It suddenly appeared, eyes blazing, and several shots rang out, but the animal ran off. When we got to the spot, there were no blood marks. Then Jacques appeared behind me, his eyes inflamed with excitement. His chest heaved with his exhortations.
"There," he said excitedly, "there!"
I followed his pointing finger, saw the branches of the thicket moving and undulating.
"There he is," Jacques screamed. "The wolf man!"
He raised his rifle before I could stop him. The explosion fell like a heavy wound on my heart. A large body lurched from the thicket and rolled almost to our feet. I ran forward in horror. Andrew sprawled on the ground, darkness running from his mouth, soaking the snow. I lifted his head, hardly knowing what I was doing. His bandaged hand fell forward over his chest. There was a gasp from the search party behind us. Andrew opened his eyes.
"I cut my finger chopping wood, father," he said very deliberately in English. "That is the truth."
Then he died. "I believe you, my boy," I said. The group around us made way for Dr. Lamar. Powerful electric torches illuminated the scene. Jekyll, the frontier guard, was stammering in my ears.
"Pardon, monsieur, a terrible tragedy, but I was right. Le loup-garou, the bandage on his hand."
I hardly heard him. There was a strange look of triumph in Jekyll's eyes, and I understood many things. As he turned away, I saw he, too, had a bandage on his right hand.